I am so thankful that you've decided to join me for another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. And I'd like for you to join me in a little bit of repeat information in 2 Kings chapter 15 and in chapter 17 as well. This is about how the northern kingdom had a change of king right around the time that Tiglath-Pileser III was moving south into the lower Middle East, taking things over, as was prophesied by the prophet Amos and the prophet Isaiah. So we're looking at the year 732 and then going into 731, where Tiglath has already killed Rezin, the king of Damascus, the king of Syria, and Ahaz, the king of southern Judah, has gone up there and visited him, basically thanking him for helping out. And then Ahaz, remember, made this huge mistake, this huge sin of desecrating the temple, taking bits and pieces of the Solomonic design apart, probably giving the material to the Assyrians, but also putting his own fraudulent, his own usurper type of sacrificial altar into the worship courtyard there at Jerusalem. We'll deal more with the sinfulness of that guy's reign later. But in 2 Kings chapter 15, at verse number 30, it says, "Then Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Bichah, the son of Remaliah, and struck him down and put him to death and reigned in his place in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah." Now that's an interesting chronological marker, because we know that Jotham reigned 16 years and then was replaced by his son, evidently. So there's something going on here chronologically. My guess, as I've already shared with you, is that Ahaz usurped his father, but did not kill him. Simply kept him on ice, kept him locked away or detained somewhere. And so whoever's doing 2 Kings 15 puts their chronological marker on the legitimate king, Jotham. 2 Kings chapter 17, though, at verse 1, says this: "In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, began to reign in Samaria over Israel, and he reigned 9 years. So the chronological marker is tied with the evil king Ahaz, the son of Jotham. But it's the same start for the king, Hoshea. So that tells me that the 20th year of Jotham, the 12th year of Ahaz, are the exact same period, the year 731 BC by our calendar, which I believe in the fall of that year was the beginning of the 98th sabbatical year for the people of Israel. And so it may be that Hoshea, as this new special year gets started, he is tired of Pekah running things into the ground and bringing the wrath of the Assyrians toward northern Israel. And so he kills King Pekah. And then there's an interesting note in Assyrian literature. There is a fragmentary text in an Assyrian document that has Tiglath-Pileser III saying that he was the one that put Hoshea on the king or on the throne of northern Israel. And so when we put together what we know from the scripture, together with what we know from the Assyrian records, it would appear that Hoshea probably reached out for permission from Tiglath-Pileser to become the new king in northern Israel, probably promised him tributary status, that they would pay money if they would just allow him to run things now that Pekah was dead and gone. And that is where we now are going to come back to the book of Hoshea. Now, Hoshea, the new king of northern Israel, shares the name with the prophet that we've already introduced, but their characters are nothing alike. Now, I wanted to save the majority of Hoshea's book of prophecies until this moment, because his story starts out with him being directed by God to marry a woman that he can't trust sexually. And then when they start having kids, children whose paternity is questionable, God directs the prophet to name them in accordance with that idea. And so the whole idea was that just like Hoshea was married but couldn't trust his wife because she cheated on him all the time and the kids didn't belong to him, that's where God is with northern Israel. Even though he loves northern Israel, he loves the people, they have been cheating on him with other gods and goddesses and other kingdoms. And the children of the kingdom don't belong to him. That is the people within the kingdom. Well, it's been 20 or so years since those babies were born. So they're all grown up now. And they're all getting married and having families of their own. And so we are ready now to do the grown-up portion of the book of Hoshea. Hoshea, chapter number 2. Verse 1, the prophet says, "Say to your brothers, you are my people." Now remember, one of the boys in Hosea's household is named Lo-Ami, which literally means not my people. So now the prophet is saying, you need to say to all your brothers, you are my people. And then say to your sisters, notice the plural there, you have received mercy. Now, one of the daughters of this family was given the prophetic name Lo-Ruhamah, which means no mercy, not loved, I think is one of the translations you see in English. But we're going to stick with the idea of mercy. So, as these kids are growing up, I believe, and this is just my opinion, so that's all it's worth to you, I believe that Hoshea loved these kids. And even though he suspected that they might not be his genetically, they were still his kids. And so I doubt very seriously that he called Lo-Ami, Lo-Ami. I think he probably called him Ami, my family, my people. And more than likely, he did not refer to Lo-Ruhamah by that literal name. I think he probably called her Ruhamah, mercy, little mercy. And so he loves these kids, and he's raised them as best he can, even though mom is wild and crazy and cheating on dad all the time. And so now they are grown up, they're out of the house, they're married, and he speaks to them. Now, this particular chapter it's like reading two things going on at the same time. There is a spiritual overlay on a physical reality. That's the way I see it. So part of the story is about Hoshea and his kids. And what he wants them to do about mom. And the other part is what needs to happen about Israel, who's been cheating on God. So here we go. Verse 2. Plead with your mother. Plead, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. So I think part of this is Hosea talking to his adult children and saying, you've got to talk to your mom. You've got to intercede on my behalf because she is so bad now that I'm going to have to take action. I'm going to have to do something about it. I can't let it go on any longer. So plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife. She's not acting like my wife. I'm not her husband. She doesn't treat me that way. Speak to her that she put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and make her as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness, and make her like a parched land, and kill her with thirst. So from Hosea's perspective, it is my opinion that Hosea is now telling his adult kids, you've got to talk to your mom because she is reached a new low. And I can't ignore it. I'm going to have to throw her out of the house. I'm going to have to take everything away from her because she's using it to do all sorts of bad stuff. And if something doesn't change, she's going to be dead. And so that's the part about the prophet story, I think. And thankfully, we're going to find out that something does happen at God's direction. But overlaid on this, remember, this is 730s going into the 720s for northern Israel. Northern Israel has less than 8 years or so left of existence. Probably only about 5 years before they come under the invasion of northern Israel that will result in their destruction. So they are in their last days as a nation. And so this is God talking to Israel as well, talking to the people, saying, you've got to talk to your fellow citizens, and you've got to talk to your mother, that is the nation, and tell her that I can't let this go on any longer. I'm going to have to divorce her and throw her out of the house and take away all her stuff. And so this now becomes an allegory or a metaphor about Israel's impending destruction. Verse 4, upon her children also I will have no mercy, because they are children of whoredom. So this is God talking about the people of northern Israel. I can't have mercy on these people when they are like their mom, the nation of Israel. They're just playing around. They're playing around with other gods and goddesses. For their mother has played the whore. That is, she's cheated on me. She has conceived them. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I'll go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Now that's the reality of northern Israel now thinking and saying and acting as if other gods and goddesses are providing their daily needs, when in fact it's actually God that's blessed them. So they are not simply cheating on God, they are assuming he has nothing to do with where they're at. And so God is going to act. Verse 6, therefore, I will hedge up her way with thorns, I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. So God is going to make it tough on northern Israel to stay on this path. She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. She shall seek them, but shall not find them. So northern Israel is going to be reaching out to other gods and goddesses, other people groups to ask for assistance soon, and they're not going to find it. And so they are going to be forced to go back to the one that really does love them. Then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. So this is prophetically looking way far ahead, when some of the people have learned from the history of Israel's grievous mistakes, and they go, no, we need to seek He who is. We need to find the true God who was there for our country, our people group at the very beginning. Verse 8, a little bit more about where northern Israel's at this time. She did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. So they are being ignorant. They're taking the blessings of God and turning around and using them to worship Baal and Asherah and other gods and goddesses. Therefore, verse 9, I will take back my grain in its time, meaning I'm going to disrupt the grain cycle. My wine in its season, I'm going to disrupt the vineyard cycle. I will take away my wool and my flax. So the whole husbandry and agricultural cycle is going to be disrupted by God. With which were to cover her nakedness. You use wool for some clothing, flax for other clothing. Flax is what you use to make linen. Verse 10. Now, I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one shall rescue her out of my hand. So God is going to bring judgment on her that nobody else can stop. And I will put an end to all her mirth, you know, her partying time, her feasts, her new moons. That's, you know, the new month. The first day of every new month was a holiday. Her Sabbaths, that's her rest days, particularly the weekly rest day, and all her appointed feasts. So I'm going to put a stop to her partying, because they're actually doing this in honor of other gods and goddesses. Even those of the golden calf cult who say they're worshiping the God who brought them out of Egypt, that's not really who they're worshiping. I will lay waste her vines and her fig trees, of which she said, oh, these are my wages which my lovers have given me. Again, very insulting to talk about the blessings of God as if they were the blessings from somebody else. I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall devour them. Once the people get pulled out of the country, it goes kind of wild. Trees grow up where there used to be fields, where there used to be vineyards. So that's what God means. I'm going to turn them into a forest because of the desolation of the land. The beasts of the field are going to multiply and eat them. The people that are left, actually, that kind of happens to the people that the Assyrians move into the country, is that the country had been empty for a period of years enough that wild animals like lions reproduced in large numbers, and they were attacking the new settlers. And so that's part of the prophecy here. Verse 13, I will punish her for the feast days of the Baalim. You know, Baal means Lord. It's primarily, when we think about Baal, we think of a thunder and lightning god of the Canaanites of the Middle East. But each idol might have a specific twist to it where it was located. And so there were multiple Baals all over the country. So that's why it's in the plural here. I'm going to punish her for the feast days of the Baals, when she burned offerings to them and adorned herself with her ring and her jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, declares He who is. So God says, I am going to bring this to an end. I am going to divorce her, kick her out of the house, take all her stuff. However, as we've been seeing, God likes to weave in to all these prophetic passages of judgment, promises of future hope and restoration. So verse 14, therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. So at some point, God is going to try again to bring these people back, or the descendants of these people, and get them to be his followers, to be his people. Verse 15, and there I will give her her vineyards. He was just talking about taking them away. Now he wants to give them back. And I will make the valley of Achor, which means the valley of trouble, and it's located not very far from the city of Jericho. I'm going to make the valley of trouble into a door of hope. So he's going to flip the script. He's going to take what was bad and make it good. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. So that is going all the way back where the Israelis coming out of Egypt were excited about God saving them. And they verbalized, at the very least, that they wanted to have a relationship with him. And so that sort of thing is coming again, according to these couple of verses of prophecy in the book of Hosea. Verse 16, in that day, declares he who is, you will call me Adoni. Excuse me, that's not right here. You will call me Ishi, which means my man, literally, but it was the Hebrew way of saying my husband. And you will no longer call me Baali, which was the Canaanite way of saying my husband, but it was also the name of Baal. And so what verse 16 is predicting is that we're going to get rid of all of this Canaanite overlay where you are thinking about things like a Canaanite, and instead you're going to start thinking about them as an Israeli, and even your verbiage is going to go back to the Hebrew roots. Verse 17, for I will remove the names of the Baal, the Baalim, the Baals, from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. Now, I actually believe verse 17 is the reason why some of the Jewish copyists changed the names of people in the time of Saul and David. You remember that? Where Ishbaal becomes Ishbosheth instead of being the man of the Lord, he becomes the man of shame. And so I told you at the time we were going through those historical periods that during that time period, the Israelis had adopted some Canaanite vocabulary. And so Baal was the word for Lord in Canaanite. And so they were actually using it as the same as Adonai, Hebrew for Lord, and they meant by that God, he who is. And so Ishbaal was actually a man of the Lord, a man of he who is. But once the copyists later, perhaps because of this prophecy right here, came across the name of Baal, they said, I'm not writing that down. I don't want anybody saying that name. And so they swapped it out for other names. Just a little something for you to think about. Now, back to the text, verse 18 of Hosea 2. And I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land, and I will make you lie down in safety. Now, wow, what are we doing here? We're coming to another millennial prophecy, aren't we? We'd seen this before, where God was saying that he was going to bring the animals back into a peaceful status quo with themselves and with people. And here he adds to it that I'm also going to get rid of war. And I'm going to let you be at peace in the land of promise. Verse 19, I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness, in justice, in chesed, or steadfast love, and in mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know he who is. And so here is God saying, yeah, right now you're on the verge of being divorced and thrown out of the house, thrown out of the country, and having all your stuff taken away because of your sinfulness, because of your betrayal of the covenant that we made. But there is a time coming in the future where, because of my love, because of my actions, I'm going to bring you back to me, and it's going to be beautiful. It's going to be wonderful, and it is going to last forever. Now, what is this other than a prophecy about Jesus Christ? And of course, in the New Testament, we have the imagery of Jesus betrothing himself to the church. And he does it by his death and his resurrection. And the promise is that he will come back in the future and finish the wedding ceremony, and then his people will be with him forever. I believe that is an exact parallel to Hosea chapter 2 at this point.